from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network. This is EWTN News Nightly.
It is the fifth day of the Novem Dialis in the city of Rome. And as the church continues to mourn Pope Francis, all eyes begin to shift toward the College of Cardinals and the upcoming conclave. Good evening, and thank you for joining us. I'm Tara Mergener. Our top story tonight: the conclave begins 1 week from today, and we're starting to hear more from the cardinals themselves about the characteristics they would like to see in a new pope. His Eminence Michael Czerny of Canada says the next pope should be a risk taker that should strive for genuine Catholicity over uniformity.
If you try to promote unity as your primary objective, you end up with uniformity. And this is exactly what we don't need. We spend decades now trying to learn to get beyond uniformity to a true Catholicity, a true pluralism.
Cardinal John Rabat of Port Moresby and Papuit New Guinea also weighed in on what attributes the next pope should have, putting a premium on personal sanctity. He said, quote, "Personal holiness is very important for the next pope. He must be someone open and controlling, not in a bad way, but in a way that keeps us all together." We are also learning more today about the two cardinals who will not take part in the conclave. They are Spanish Cardinal Antonio Canzanares and Kenyan Cardinal John Nunjua. Both will miss the conclave due to health issues. EWTN's Colm Flynn has been following the actions of the cardinals in Rome. He joins us now from the Vatican.
A very good evening, Tara, from Rome. Tonight, we're just days away from the start of the conclave, and already key decisions are being made behind the Vatican walls about how this historic election will unfold. First, the College of Cardinals have confirmed that all 133 eligible cardinals under the age of 80 will be allowed to vote for the next pope, even though church law technically states that the voting limit is 120. That rule comes from the Apostolic Constitution, which governs how conclaves are run. But that same decree declares that any cardinal under the age of 80 who was legitimately created by a pope has the right to take part, even if that means there will be more than 120 electors. During his papacy, the late Pope Francis appointed more than 120 voting cardinals, effectively bypassing that cap. But both Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI also exceeded that cap during their pontificates. It was also announced that the cardinals have expressed their appreciation for the decision of Cardinal Angelo Becciu to voluntarily withdraw from the conclave, a decision that he says he made for the good of the church. Cardinal Becciu, who has been embroiled in a high-profile Vatican corruption case and found guilty of embezzlement and fraud, claims he wasn't barred from voting, but says he hopes his absence will help maintain serenity and unity during the process. Now, Cardinal Becciu explained that he decided to obey the will of Pope Francis, who had expressed the desire that he not take part in the conclave, though he continues to maintain his innocence. Meanwhile, the Seventh General Congregation, that's the formal gathering of cardinals ahead of the conclave, met today with 180 in attendance, and of those, 124 were electors. And their discussions went beyond the logistics of voting. A significant portion of the session was dedicated to the finances of the Holy See. Cardinal Reinhard Marx from Germany presented financial challenges and proposals for the Vatican to ensure that its resources could continue to support the reforms that began under Pope Francis. Then Cardinal Christoph Schönborn from Austria spoke about transparency and oversight, while Cardinal Konrad Krajewski from Poland offered an update on the church's charitable works. There was also a deep reflection on the life of the church, with several cardinals urging for a renewed focus on synodality and unity among bishops as a way to heal polarization, both inside the church and in wider society. The themes emerging here are clear: reform, financial transparency, and a desire for greater unity. All of it is laying the groundwork for the papal election, set to start in just a few days' time. But for now, that is the update and the latest from Rome. At the Vatican, Colm Flynn for EWTN News Nightly.
And with the conclave approaching, many are speculating on who might be the man to succeed Pope Francis as the new pope of the Catholic Church. Many names have emerged, and one of them is that of Cardinal Pier Battista Pizzaballa, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem. EWTN Vatican correspondent Valentina Di Donato is in Rome with the latest.
The youth of Jesus' homeland, for the Christian Palestinian youth, came to Rome hoping to witness the canonization of Blessed Carlo Acutis. But instead, they found themselves here for the funeral of Pope Francis. Led by Father Firas Abedrabo, the former personal secretary of Cardinal Pizzaballa, the group of teenagers share a deep devotion to Pope Francis due to his fervent calls for peace and justice. Now they eagerly await to see who will be the next pope, and like many, advocate for one of their own. Cardinal Pizzaballa is one of the names circulating at the moment as a possible candidate.
I know Pizzaballa. He was a simple friar, then teacher, then custos, and then patriarch. He didn't change, so I don't think he will change.
Father Firas, speculating on the prospects of the man who ordained him, described Cardinal Pizzaballa, a Franciscan and the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, as a man of deep integrity who he saw during his first years as a priest, working in one of the world's most complex places. Created cardinal just 1 week before the October 7th attacks, he was from the start vocal on condemning the violence on civilians, calling for de-escalation and the need for humanitarian aid to enter Gaza.
It was very complicated when Daesh, when ISIS took power there and even sometimes controlled, I think, some convents or even took some friars. He led this crisis in a way which at the end kept the presence of the Franciscan there possible.
Father Firas explained how Christians, who only make up 1% of the Holy Land's population today, are meant to support anybody who finds their human dignity threatened.
The Christians in the world have a mission to be peacemakers, not war makers. This is very important. They have a mission to be pro-life, not pro-death.
This is a point that Pope Francis repeatedly made about this conflict.
This is cruelty. This is not war.
Questo non è guerra.
Cardinal Pizzaballa has continued Pope Francis's legacy of fostering a culture of encounter. From the third day of the war until 2 days before his death, Pope Francis called the only Catholic parish in Gaza every night, building a bond with the priests and the parishioners during the ongoing war. Students from Palestine, like Jerry's, tells EWTN about how Pope Francis's nightly calls to Gaza made him proud of his faith and his origins.
That would mean that the Lord had given us somebody who, who follows his teachings correctly, who preserved our faith, someone who stands with justice.
And I'm very thankful to live in such a city. It's amazing, and it has the birth of Jesus Christ. We're very proud Christians, and I'm proud of myself. And I thank everybody, and I want to pray for the children in Gaza and their parents.
In Rome, Valentina Di Donato for EWTN News Nightly.
EWTN's National Catholic Register is also examining the qualities to look for in the next leader of the global Catholic Church. In an opinion piece today, senior contributor Edward Penton says, in part, quote, "At a minimum, he should possess a strong faith and humility, be willing to adhere to the Church's teachings and apostolic tradition, and personify the Pope's ancient title as the servant of the servants of God." Penton adds that unlike a politician focused solely on this world, a pope's chief responsibility is helping to guide millions of souls to the next, using the three duties of a bishop: teach, govern, and sanctify. Well, as we mentioned, the conclave begins May 7th, and one church leader in Germany is not expecting it to end quickly. Cardinal Rainer Wolke says he does not expect this conclave to go as quickly as the last one. He adds the pre-conclave meetings are going well, saying most of the cardinals haven't seen each other for a long time, and many are happy and have been happy to see each other again. The previous conclave in 2013 that elected Pope Francis lasted only 2 days. Well, we have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, a one-of-a-kind meeting. President Trump gathers his cabinet for a live on-camera review of his first 100 days. And learn all about a courtroom decision today involving a Palestinian student at Columbia University. President Donald Trump calls his cabinet together for a review of the administration's first 100 days in office. China, the economy, public safety, and military recruitment were among the key topics. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Good evening. The cabinet meeting lasted a couple of hours, broadcast live for all to see. The president went around the room asking his secretaries for a summary.
President Donald Trump tells his cabinet China is getting absolutely hammered by tariffs.
I know that China is doing very poorly right now. I just saw some reports coming out, and I don't want that to happen to China. I like the president a lot, President Xi. I don't want it to happen.
And the president says Chinese ships are doing a big U-turn and going back.
They're sending boats, the biggest boats in the world, carrying cargo like nobody's ever seen before. These are the biggest boats in the world, biggest cargo ships in the world, and they're coming and they're turning around in the Pacific Ocean.
The president's comments come as a report shows the U.S. economy may have shrunk at the start of the year. A few seats over, meanwhile, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick tells his boss,
you've never seen anything like the companies committed to building in America. Technology companies have committed over $2.5 trillion to build in America based on your tariffs.
As the president went around the table, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent added,
it's been a momentous 100 days with you at the helm, and I view this 100 days as setting the table for peace deals, trade deals, tax deals.
And he said American families are finding their financial footing again.
Energy costs have plummeted, mortgage rates are down, food costs are moving lower.
Vice President J.D. Vance also weighed in, talking military numbers.
But the most underreported fact of the first 100 days is that we came in with a massive recruitment shortfall. And in 100 days of Secretary Hegseth and President Trump's leadership, we now have people breaking down the doors to join our military.
And when it got around to Attorney General Pam Bondi,
we are going after terrorism. We are going after arsonists. Whether you're burning Teslas, we will see. We've arrested 9 people so far in 7 jurisdictions. No negotiations, 20 years in prison, or you're burning down the governor's mansion in Pennsylvania. We will be there to protect you.
The education secretary drew laughter when she said this.
I don't think I have ever worked so hard to try to fire myself.
And before allowing reporters to ask questions, the president wrapped it up.
I just want to thank everybody. This is really very impressive, and I hope the people at home got to see some of it. Nobody's ever done public cabinet meetings.
On the economy, another report showed inflation slowing in the month of March. But Democrats warn the president is dragging the country towards a recession and shrinking the economy. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, Owen, thank you. Well, now to the Middle East, where at least a dozen are dead following new Israeli airstrikes, according to Palestinian health authorities. Israel has been keeping up daily strikes in Gaza since resuming the war with Hamas. Israel says its campaign aims to pressure the terrorist organization to release hostages taken on October 7th, 2023. Meanwhile, aid groups say thousands of Palestinian children are malnourished due to lack of food and resources in the region. Meanwhile, Lebanese President Joseph Aoun is calling on the U.S. to pressure Israel to withdraw from areas it still controls in the country and to release Lebanese prisoners. On Wednesday, the Lebanese leader says his army is already working along the Israeli border, seizing weapons and preventing an armed presence by Hezbollah. Back in the U.S., a detained Columbia University student is celebrating his freedom outside of a Vermont courthouse. (laughs) Mohsen Mahdawi was ordered to be released from ICE detention by a Vermont federal judge 2 weeks ago. He was arrested by immigration agents during an interview to finalize his U.S. citizenship. He's been a legal resident for 10 years. His lawyers say the arrest was retaliation for speaking out on Palestinian human rights. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, can a public charter school be religious? A major court case could change how church and state coexist in the classroom. The Archdiocese of New Orleans has been ordered to appear in federal court to defend ongoing proceedings in its year-long bankruptcy. The judge is concerned because there has been no resolution after years of court cases. In May 2020, the Archdiocese filed for bankruptcy amid financial pressure from clergy abuse lawsuits. The Supreme Court is considering a case with major implications for religious liberty. The justices are set to decide whether a Catholic public charter school, St. Isidore Charter School, can open in Oklahoma and be funded with taxpayer dollars. If so, it would become the nation's first religious public charter school in the United States. Correspondent Eric Rosales reports outside the U.S. Supreme Court. Eric, what do you think?
Well, good evening, Tara. This is a blockbuster case for Catholics and those of other faiths. The key question is, can charter schools be religious, or is it a violation between church and state? A ruling in favor of St. Isidore Charter School would mean government sponsorship of a school guided by the teachings of the Catholic Church.
Parents are empowered to choose the education option that's best suited for their children based on their circumstances. And if that is within the religious context, then I think that needs to be supported.
The whole theory about separation of church and state really applies only to where the government is providing the education. Ordinary public school, ordinary district school, that's a government-run operation. They can tax. They've got politically elected officials. Now, we're talking about charters, which are really just private. They're private entities applying for public benefit.
But Oklahoma's Republican Attorney General says charter schools are no different from public schools.
Charter schools are created by the state, funded by the state, overseen by the state. Its teachers are eligible for public retirement, public school retirement. Its boards are subject to open records, open meetings, and in every essence, every indicia of a governmental actor.
Others, including Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor, says it could force taxpayers to fund religious indoctrination and discrimination.
If they decide to change their operation because they don't want to become religious, because they want a secular education, that he's open to an attack that they're being motivated by hostility to religion. So you'll be back in another free exercise claim.
Chief Justice John Roberts appears to hold the deciding vote because Justice Amy Coney Barrett recused herself. The lawyer who argued the case on behalf of charter schools says he's optimistic the justices will side with them.
We're right on the law. We're optimistic because the court has recognized three times in the last 8 years that when a state creates a program and invites private groups to be a part, it can't look at the religious groups alone and say, you're not welcome.
This case will have major implications for the future of public charter schools and, even for that fact, parochial schools. Several Republican senators filed amicus briefs to the high court supporting the Catholic charter school. A decision is expected in late June. Reporting outside the U.S. Supreme Court, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Eric, thank you. A lot of eyes on this case, certainly. Joining us now to discuss this is Kate Anderson, senior counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. Kate, thank you so much for joining us. What do you make of the arguments made in the case today so far?
Well, we're very hopeful by the questions and the focus of the Supreme Court today. This is an important case because it's about providing more options, great education for kids in the state of Oklahoma and across the country. And I think you saw the court engaging with the important issues of the case.
If this does go forward and you have the first religious charter school, there's a lot of arguments on both sides about what this could mean. What is the impact going to be, in your opinion?
Well, the impact is important because we're trying to provide better education. Every kid deserves a quality education. And that's why the statewide charter school board approved St. Isidore's, because they saw what great quality education the Catholic diocese had been providing in the state. And they wanted this option for parents in the state. The school was only disapproved eventually because of its religious character, which is religious discrimination, and that's something that the Supreme Court has said over and over again.
And we, just as you just mentioned, we've got a couple of arguments here, right? We've got the anti-religious discrimination, but the detractors say this represents a violation of church and state. So how do you evaluate how the justices have responded so far? Any idea which way this could go?
Well, we're hopeful. They were engaging with the right questions. And the Establishment Clause, which is what is brought up in this division between church and state, is really about making sure that religion is treated fairly. There's no picking or choosing, that religious people and religious organizations are not treated unfairly. But that's exactly what was happening in this case. And we're hopeful that the justices will remedy it.
Absolutely. And while everything is settling in court, what is happening at St. Isidore, the school itself? What's going on in the school? How are they taking it? All the national attention.
Well, the St. Isidore was set up, and there were 200 families that wanted to go to this school. It would have served students across the state because it was virtual, so it was open to all students no matter their economic situation or their location. But because of the state Supreme Court's decision, St. Isidore has not been able to open its doors. So we're hopeful that after the U.S. Supreme Court weighs in, they will be able to open their school and be available to students across the state.
And it sounds like you are pretty optimistic about how this is going to play it out in the end.
We are. There's a series of cases that have come out from the court before on this issue. When the state creates a program like the charter school program, invites private organizations to come into that and provide public services, they can't exclude an organization simply because of their religious beliefs, and that's exactly what happened here.
Do you think that more cases will follow after this? Are you expecting, you know, more schools to come forward and file suit, or more parents? What are you thinking?
Well, we'll see how this tracks down, but if the court rules the way that we're hopeful, this opens the door in Oklahoma to this great Catholic virtual school for students there, and it opens the door across the nation for states to make decisions about how they want to run their school programs, how they want to run their charter schools, to make this available to religious parents across the nation.
Wow, Kate, thank you so much. So much at stake, and all eyes certainly on this case.
It's an exciting one.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Finally tonight, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson delivered powerful remarks during a keynote address at the Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America Gala, explaining his journey with the pro-life movement.
I myself am a product of an unplanned pregnancy. In January 1972, almost exactly a year before Roe, I was born January 30th of 72, my parents, who were just teenagers at the time, chose life. And
The gala featured several leading pro-life voices celebrating the pro-life movement and renewing the fight for every baby and every mom. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram, and EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tara Merchant. Good night, and God bless.